I next met with Dr. Trena, who discussed treatment of breast cancers during the pandemic.
It's really a pleasure to be with you and to spend some time chatting about what my experience has been in treating women with breast cancer through the COVID pandemic. And that is obviously still ongoing, but in my experience at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, really at the heart of this for many months, I thought we'd start disease state by disease state within breast cancer and share with you a bit about our treatment paradigm prior to COVID and how we've had to react to that and potentially adjust or modify in the setting of the pandemic. So on the left side of the slide here, I've summarized the approach to patients with HER2-positive localized breast cancer, early stage disease. And this paradigm, I think, is relatively shared in many practice settings that for tumors that were larger than 2 centimeters or node positive, we've really followed a paradigm of neoadjuvant pre-op chemotherapy with dual HER2-targeted therapy of trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And there may be variation as to which chemotherapy backbone is your preference, but there's flexibility here. And so whether patients are receiving dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, or docetaxel, carboplatin, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, these are both very reasonable pre-op regimens. And then patients would go on to surgery, and based on their response at the time of surgery, whether they achieve a pathologic complete response or not, would dictate the remainder of their adjuvant therapy course. And for those patients who achieved a pathologic complete response, they have an excellent prognosis, and they would go on to receive trastuzumab and pertuzumab to finish out their adjuvant therapy. And if they had hormone receptor positive disease, they would also begin their concurrent endocrine therapy. We know that the Catherine data supported for those patients who failed to achieve a pathologic complete response, switching over to T-DM1 was really associated with improved outcomes for those patients. And that has really been well embraced and a standard of care now. So how did things change in the setting of the pandemic? And it probably makes sense to just establish some guiding principles and our philosophy in caring for women. You know, in March of this year, when the pandemic really took off in New York City, we really had so much uncertainty ahead of us. There was an absence of data of how this virus behaved, how we could optimally manage it, what the wave was going to look like. And really, the safety of our patients and staff and our communities was of primary concern. Yet we also wanted to be sure that we were following evidence-based medicine, that we were making treatment decisions that favored where there's a survival advantage, giving our patients that opportunity. And so if we had to stratify allocation of resources and taking on the risk of patients coming out of their homes and into a clinical environment, we wanted to preferentially offer that to patients who were being treated in the curative setting, where we really didn't want to compromise excellent survival outcomes. We also needed to consider the balancing of regimen frequency and scheduling. How often would patients need to come out of their homes, minimize social distancing for the sake of receiving therapy in an ambulatory care setting? We had to consider toxicities of various regimens with a concern about perhaps patients being immunocompromised as a result of chemotherapy or concerns around checkpoint inhibitor toxicities. So many of these factors that were entering into the calculus and risk-benefit analysis of what would be in the best interest for our patients. Our radiation oncology colleagues quickly embraced evidence-based alternative schedules where they were able to abbreviate radiation courses to minimize time on site. And I think what we came to recognize is that we wanted minimal exposure, minimal time around others, obviously having appropriate PPE, appropriate social distancing in the ambulatory care setting to keep everybody safe. And so with that, with collaboration and conversations with our surgeons and our radiation oncologists, for those patients who are already in the midst of their treatment plans, we really did all we could in this early stage setting to continue those plans and those regimens. I'm sure you've experienced that state by state, there were regulatory changes as to what surgeries were permitted to happen. Many elective surgeries were suspended as a result of these state mandates. Fortunately, cancer-related surgeries, for the most part, were considered essential and non-elective. And so we were able to really proceed in the curative setting with our standard of care approach for those patients with T2 or greater or node positive disease embarking on neoadjuvant therapy. I will say that I tend to favor the AC-THP regimen in practice. There were circumstances where I flipped the regimen order such that I was delivering weekly paclitaxel, which is very well tolerated. So even though it was a weekly regimen, I was preferentially favoring reducing periods of neutropenia for the sake of quickly allowing somebody to be in the ambulatory care setting, get their 1 hour paclitaxel and dual HER2 targeted therapy and get home again, as opposed to dealing with nadir periods and neutropenia, using growth factor support as necessary and where necessary, obviously, to help protect our patients. So I think moving on from the HER2 positive space, where, you know, here in this setting, we know that the benefits of dual HER2 targeted therapy are so significant that we really do not want to compromise those survival advantages. I think we can move on next to look at the setting of HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. And this is a space where we have so many new exciting options, and we can really evaluate toxicity profiles, scheduling, and all of these factors, including the ones I just mentioned, in what might be in the best interest of our patients. So I think that we're all likely in agreement that in the first line setting, taxanes and trastuzumab, pertuzumab, based on the CLEOPATRA data, really a standard of care. There may be circumstances in patients who have limited volume disease, ER positive, HER2 positive breast cancer, perhaps older postmenopausal women, that we could consider first line endocrine therapy and HER2 targeted approach. But generally, this CLEOPATRA regimen holds the first line standard of care. In the second line setting, we've had T-DM1 for many years now, but most recently in our armamentarium, based on the HER2 CLIMB data, is the catinib, trastuzumab, and capecitabine as a very reasonable option for patients who've previously seen both trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And beyond this second line setting, we really have many, many options, and the art of medicine begins to dictate our choices here. Again, you'll see some of the regimens already discussed, such as tucatinib, trastuzumab, and capecitabine. We have a recent FDA approval for trastuzumab, deruxtecan, and this very active drug was FDA approved really based on phase 2 data. The randomized phase 3 study has been ongoing, but just from that phase 2 data, we've seen really impressive response rates, beautiful waterfall plots like I just haven't seen before with other agents, and very compelling efficacy compared to historic controls. So it'll be really interesting to see those phase 3 data as they mature. We have T-DM1, we have capecitabine and other TKI combinations like lapatinib and neratinib. And then we really have the flexibility of any of our other standard of care chemotherapy drugs added to trastuzumab. And so in the setting of the pandemic, again, talking about some general guiding principles, we always were making decisions in the context of maintaining social distancing, reducing unnecessary exposures to the health system, and minimizing amount of time exposed to others. Around the same time, we've had the availability of subcutaneous trastuzumab. And for those patients who were receiving just trastuzumab and another chemotherapy agent, this was a nice alternative. The requirement for time in an infusion center is really minimal, in a matter of minutes rather than an hour or less. And so this offered some flexibility and actually more rapid turnaround for patients to be able to get them back home again. There were even some interesting trials going on to support home infusion of trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the subcutaneous setting. And so these were all really reasonable alternatives that folks were willing to embrace more rapidly because we were looking at ways to innovate and keep our patients in a safer environment. Oral regimens were certainly convenient, and with pharmacies that were able to ship drug to patients' homes and monitoring remotely and embracing telemedicine, it was really an opportunity, again, to keep our patients safe and to have greater convenience. I think that our experience probably reflects what's going on around the country, that often our patients need a caregiver or another provider to potentially help get them to their appointments and home again. And there were limitations around the pandemic about visitor policies. And this is such a stressful time for patients and their families that permitting patients to get care in their home was really preferential and embraced. And then I think lastly, it's worth touching on caution around particular adverse events that may have compromised patients in the setting of a pandemic. So this was all really based on largely opinion and safety rather than evidence, but we do know that certain agents have pulmonary toxicity associated with them. Trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is really highly active, as I mentioned before, does have a risk of ILD associated with it. And on study, there were rare deaths, but there were a few deaths that did occur. And so I think my colleagues and I and others that I've spoken to as well took pause in considering what the risk-benefit balance was for any of the treatments that we were deciding upon in the setting of these past few months with the pandemic present. But remembering that advanced disease in the incurable setting, where the goal of our therapy is palliative, really requires a careful risk-benefit analysis to say, how are we helping our patients? Will the choice of administering this particular drug offer them greater palliation or potentially place them at greater risk? And I think that we were all struggling with these decisions and risk-benefit balance. I don't think that we have evidence to guide us here. And that's why I want to be very careful about saying that this is really an experience, an opinion, and what we really truly need is investigators and practitioners around the country coming together to talk about their experiences and get some evidence behind the practices that have been deployed. The next setting that was really quite challenging is around metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. As you know, most of the therapies that we have available for these patients are intravenous, are really a backbone of cytotoxic chemotherapy. In the first-line setting, we've had the introduction of checkpoint inhibitors. So for those patients that had PD-L1 positive tumors using the Ventana SP142 antibody, we've had approval for first-line nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab. Coming soon, potentially, is the ability to use pembrolizumab in that first-line setting based on KEYNOTE-355. And this study looked at other chemotherapy backbones like nab-paclitaxel, paclitaxel, or the gemcitabine carboplatin doublet with or without pembrolizumab. And there appeared to be benefit seen in the population of patients that had PD-L1 positive using a different antibody, 22C3, using a different scoring system, a CPS of greater than or equal to 10%, which appeared to support the addition of pembro. But the vast majority of patients, about 60% of these patients, have PD-L1 negative tumors. And in the first line setting, our options are often standard chemotherapy. So I've listed a few options here that are often our go-to. And then lastly, for those patients who have a germline BRCA mutation, we have two randomized phase 3 studies that have supported the FDA approval of olaparib or talazoparib, the PARP inhibitors, for the treatment of these patients with germline BRCA mutations. So in this setting, in the first line setting for metastatic triple negative breast cancer, for my patients with PD-L1 positive tumors, I continued checkpoint inhibition with their backbone chemotherapy because the data from IMPASSION was quite compelling for a potential improvement, not just in progression-free survival, but even a substantial trend in overall survival benefit. We also had some encouraging data in-house from Memorial looking at our own experience with our patients who were COVID positive and had active cancer requiring systemic therapy, including chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibition. And it really appeared that those patients receiving active therapy with COVID did no worse than those patients who were not on therapy. So I favored here, given the risk of advanced triple negative breast cancer, continuing on evidence-based medicine to treat the cancer and support all the other practices that were necessary to keep patients safe from COVID. Once we move on to the second line and later, you know, many of our treatment options remain the same. There was a recent FDA approval in the third line setting and later for sacituzumab, govitecan, that's the antibody drug conjugate that is targeting TROP2 of a biomarker was not necessary for benefit from this agent. And again, given the profound responses and clinical benefit seen with that drug, this was really an option embraced for the appropriate patients because of the benefits seen in treating the underlying disease. These are difficult decisions for sure, but it was always a risk-benefit balance between how can we appropriately and adequately treat the cancer and how can we support the patient, their families, and all the other sort of psychosocial limitations around care of cancer in the setting of COVID. So in the ER-positive space, we had a bit more flexibility. On the left, you'll see the pre-COVID experience where endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors is by far our first-line standard of care option. And whether the endocrine therapy backbone was ovarian suppression in an AI or fulvestrant, we have both alternatives. Second-line endocrine therapy is often fulvestrant with or without a PI3 kinase inhibitor based on a patient's tumor's PI3 kinase status. And then beyond third line and later, we're really looking at other alternative endocrine therapies that they may not have seen previously, potentially in combination with the mTOR inhibitor everolimus or just a single agent endocrine therapy. And chemotherapy really is reserved for once we've exhausted endocrine therapy and targeted therapy options. So in the post-COVID and peri-COVID experience, there were a few modifications made for patients with hormone-driven breast cancer. And the first was around those who required ovarian suppression. So traditionally, we would favor an every four-week regimen of leuprolide, but this requires in-person visits for this injection, for this intramuscular injection. And so in the setting of the pandemic, we did convert to the longer dosing strategy of using the every 12-week dose, but dosing again at every 10 weeks out of concern that if a premenopausal patient had their ovarian suppression wearing off, the benefit then of their aromatase inhibitor would be questionable. So our convention is to dose a little bit sooner than that 12-week period. Also, given the option of an oral aromatase inhibitor as compared to fulvestrant, it was much more convenient for many women to be on the aromatase inhibitor instead of requiring the every four-week injection of fulvestrant. So if a decision was being made to initiate therapy, we would favor the oral therapy during this time. For those patients that were on fulvestrant, many were able to continue treatment, but some did elect to convert over to oral aromatase inhibitor therapy or even tamoxifen for convenience, for minimizing time coming into the health system or even travel. And then I think another consideration was related to the adverse events associated with targeted therapy. So for those patients that were on CDK4/6 inhibitors for quite some time, on a stable dose, really without periods of neutropenia, we had greater comfort maintaining that regimen because, again, the benefits of adding that to endocrine therapy across subsets was maintained. Alpelisib also, you know, in terms of toxicity, did require a bit more management in terms of monitoring for hyperglycemia, concern about rash, which would necessitate use of Benadryl or other non-sedating antihistamines. And so it did require a little bit more management, but again, its benefits were substantial. And a lot of the management for this could be instituted locally without requiring visits into the health system. And so I think, again, the benefit of incorporating targeted therapy over endocrine therapy was favored, but obviously temporary modifications were certainly embraced and possible.